Welcome to The Ugly Podcast, the place where creatives are encouraged to make messy, ugly art and to redefine their relationship to their inner critic. Every other week, I am joined by creatives of all mediums and methods to discuss our creative processes and how we navigate the mental minefield of creativity. This podcast serves as a reminder that you and your art get to be whatever the hell you want to be, ugly and all. Welcome back to The Ugly Podcast. I'm your host, Lauren Alexander. I use they, them pronouns, as you know. And I have a new guest for you all today. My guest is somebody who uses art and technology to explore disability as a hotbed of innovation. Welcome. Will you please introduce yourself with your name and pronouns, please?
Hi, I'm Em. I use they, them pronouns. Or sorry, M. Eifler. I do possess a last name. Do you do visual description on your podcast?
I haven't, but I should. I should start doing that. Yes.
So but I am a light-skinned, tall person wearing chonky headphones and big blue glasses. I have very ruddy cheeks, and I'm wearing a big fluffy winter outfit.
Amazing. Oh, fluffy winter. That's what we need right now. It's so cold. Well, you might be a little warmer down there, but maybe not. You can correct me if I'm wrong.
San Francisco is cold, but not freezing. Pleasantly cold.
Pleasantly cold.
Cold enough to keep all the windows open, in my opinion.
Yeah, here it is 35 degrees outside. A little chilly.
Yeah, no, it's not.
I'm so grateful that you're here, and also just that I stumbled across you on Instagram, and just especially your Art School from Bed series. I think so for a little bit about me, I never used to think I was a creative person because I had this vision of what creative people did, what they looked like, what mm-hmm. they acted like, what they made, and I was like, I'm none of those things. So I am not creative.
Mm-hmm.
And what I just love so much that you're like, no, none of that's all bullshit. We don't want any of that. We want creativity to be innovative and new and accessible. And I just love that so much.
Yeah, there's, I think we often get stuck in like the, is it art with a capital A? Is it dance with a capital D? Like, is it mm-hmm. music? Do you have an audience? Especially now with, you know, internet life being so central to all of our experiences, you yeah. can sort of get caught up in like, what niche do you fill, and how does the algorithm perceive your work? And, like, there's a lot right. of ways that we sort of box in what we consider like creative aspects of our lives, and I am just interested in ways that people act in creative and interesting ways that don't apply specifically to I am doing art now.
Right. Yeah.
And often, and if you'd like to read more about this, there's a book called Activist Affordances, but generally, like, in disabled lives, you are sort of forced by the constraints of your own body and environment to create a world for yourself that specifically works for your body. You can't mm-hmm. bend your wrist. What is the dance that you invent to put the coffee cup on the table? Mm-hmm. And if you, you know, if you've come up against a lot of constraints in your life, and, you know, not just disabled people, everybody has constraints in their life, and yeah. those constraints and working with them are sort of how we start approaching our own creative practice. And then, you know, you might build it out from there. You might learn like, oh, well, I find this really interesting and I want to highlight that. And you sort of work from there. But the idea that we have to like work from skill in drawing realistically, like towards something mm-hmm. and call that art, I'm like, no, thank you. Let's start from everyone's individual body and sort of build up from there a language of art and creativity and and how we use those things to like speak about ourselves to each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I love all of that so much. And also, like, if you do not have a disability now, or you do not have that experience at the moment, we all have very fragile bodies and we will like all experience disability at some point in our lives, unless you die very suddenly and tragically, in which case maybe not. But like, disability is in all of our futures. And if you can see your creativity as something that can change and move with you, then like, it just opens up so much more like hope and wonder and like, oh, disability isn't some like big scary thing that I have to avoid at all costs or like feel shame or closed off because it's in my life. It's no, it can enrich my creativity and I can access all of these different things that I never thought I could before. I think that's just so special and wonderful for all of us.
And I think disability has, at least for me, has become this way of thinking about like all forms of oppression. Mm-hmm. Because most forms of oppression live in our bodies. They come to us because of something about our bodies, whether that's your gender or your skin color or your height, or like there's a lot of ways that people experience oppression that is generated from how other people experience their bodies. And disability justice and disability studies have spent a long time thinking about this vast diversity of the ways that people experience disability and how those different experiences of like the diversity of how you can be a human and how those mm-hmm. things like work together to form like disability identity as like the big thing that when you say you're disabled, you're sort of like opting into a political identity almost.
Yeah.
But how it relates to not just intersectionality, but like almost as an umbrella for all bodies to be welcomed in. And if you don't currently experience yourself as disabled, why is that? Mm. What is it about your built environment and about your informational environment, about like the world around you, that has been built very specifically for bodies mm-hmm. just like yours? And that's why I developed Art School from Bed, was because I went to art school. I have a master's degree in fine art. And let me tell you, they were not real interested in building accommodations specifically for like me and my art practice, even to the extent that like work I built was called not art. Like I was told my work wasn't art.
Wow.
Which I was like, that's real interesting perspective that you got there.
What? I'm so curious about, do you mind sharing the context of that situation? Or like,
sure.
What?
So yeah, I was like, in grad school, you tend to go through these like review processes and the professors sort of like give you feedback on the projects that you're making. And you can like pass or not pass one of these reviews depending on like certain rubrics.
Mm-hmm.
And in my final review, like my graduation review, my entire degree is hanging on this. One of the professors that was like responsible for like whether or not I got to graduate decided that the work that I was building, which was essentially a video game you couldn't win, is just an environment that you walked around in that slowly decayed as you walked around in it. There was no, you couldn't win it. Like it was just, you know, it was like a virtual environment that you walked around in. And now today people would be like, yeah, like that's, you know, digital work about the body, like decaying, like that's definitely art. But at the time, you know, in 2011, it wasn't quite like using digital media. One was like not something they really understood, and then another like, oh well, this is about like my experience as a disabled person, was also just like, no, mm-hmm. this is, you're doing activism.
Wow.
Or you're making video games and as doing if, activism. This isn't art.
As if as if activism and art are completely separate. What?
Yeah. So I experienced, you know, their view of like who I was and what my body meant to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized like, oh, there's no way I could be the only person experiencing this.
Yeah.
So for a long time in my art practice, I've been developing like simulations and models and prosthetics to try and understand disabled and autistic specifically, because I'm autistic, ways of knowing and ways of being. not, you know, things that are nonverbal, things that are, you know, new taxonomies, all these different kinds of like ways of building knowledge in my art practice. And then recently I decided that I wanted to teach art, but I wanted to teach it from the perspective of someone who is disabled and is interested in how other disabled people build their own world. So mm-hmm. I wanted to start teaching art skills from like that perspective and bringing in people's very important to me, like world knowledge. Like, what do you know about the world that no one else does because of your body and your mm-hmm. experience of the world through that body? So I started trying to like, I'm experimenting now with like, how do I teach art without saying like, I am the arbiter of creative practice and you yeah. student shall come to me and I shall give unto you the wisdom and I shall also judge you as to whether or not what you're doing is correct. Like uh-huh. I'm not interested in that. And that's really what I got in grad school.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm experimenting now with art school in bed. It's just how do you not just teach art practice, but identify creative practices people are already doing, encourage it, and help people define their own personal creative practice as art.
Yeah. Yeah, that is. Yeah, I'm soaking it all in. I love it. That's kind of what I've been trying to do as well with like this ugly art practice and encouraging people to make ugly things. It's not that I need you to just make bad art. It's that I need you to experiment and be willing to go to that place where you think, no, this can't possibly be art, and say, well, what if it is? What if me scribbling on this page is art? What if that is exactly what it's supposed to be?
And what are the goals of your art practice?
Mm-hmm.
If the goal of your art practice is to make beautiful illustrations that you can sell easily to a company so that they can use those illustrations on their website, like that's a very particular kind of art and a very particular yeah. kind of need.
Mm-hmm.
And there are established practices for how to develop that skill. But if, like for me, my art practice is definitely, well, what happens when you mush these two things together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. yeah.
So I'm not, there is no judgment to say that like one of those is better or worse.
Yeah.
But in order to find and develop new, like established paradigms of art making, you have to like do a bunch of stuff that doesn't work.
Yeah. It's like turning into a mad scientist of art.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I actually think that using like scientific method, like in art practice, is like a very fruitful way of going about things, like having hypotheses, doing experimentation, having tests, comparing outcomes, like, you know, like using that framework for experimentation helps it feel safer to experiment. And it feels I feel sometimes artists feel like, well, every single thing I make has to be like good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you're saying with like ugly, right?
Mm-hmm.
But having the framework of like, okay, well, I'm doing these specific experiments for a purpose sometimes can help people like break out of that need for everything to be like perfect and beautiful every time.
Yeah. And like getting in, because we're so wired to think what I'm doing needs to have a purpose. And so if you want your art to have a purpose, then yeah, like you're saying, give it a purpose then. Give the messy art, give the mistakes, give the experimentation a purpose. And that purpose is finding your style, finding what you want to say, that it all has a purpose. And so if you struggle thinking like, I can't make a mess because it'll be a waste of materials, it'll be a waste of my time, it'll be a waste of whatever, make it not a waste. Just reframe that and say, nope, none of this is a waste, and it can all be repurposed, and it's all learning, and it's all information.
I love the idea of wasting materials. I think because I also had that fear for a long time of like, none of what I make matters, I can't like sell anything, like I've never sold work in the almost 20 years I've been an artist, like
mm-hmm.
I had that like fear and like clenched feeling around my work. And so I just started making stuff with trash. Uh-huh. Like,
yeah.
All of my textiles are reclaimed. All of the like paper paintings and stuff are painted on like stuff I found at the thrift store, stuff I've leftover newspaper. Like, mm-hmm. I have very intentionally crafted my entire art practice around just using leftover stuff. And part of that was around because of that fear. And part of it was also like, I'm making work about disabled people who the entire universe thinks are just like useless piles of junk. Mm-hmm. So I might as well show you how you can make useless piles of junk into cool shit, because disabled people are cool.
Yes. Yes.
Like, we do so many cool things. So I think both of those came together in my work to be like, yes, I'm going to use every single trash.
Use all the trash.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. We have this idea that everything we do has to be good or have value. This belief leads us to burnout. It can hold us back from creating altogether. But in my Ugly Art 101 course, I break down these restrictive beliefs and lead you through exercises that intentionally subvert perfectionism and bring playfulness back into your creative process. You can get the first day absolutely free by going to my website, scribeandsunshine.com, and signing up on the homepage. Join me in my weird ugly art revolution. Back to the show. We've already been talking a lot about kind of your history with this, but I am curious, what was your relationship like to creativity when you were younger? What made you kind of go down this path of, you know, getting a master's degree in art? How has that evolved for you?
So I had to ask my mom this question. I should preface by saying, so I have a brain injury, and the brain injury means I have no functioning long-term memory. So I talked to my mom, and I was like, Mama, what was I like? And she was telling me two stories, one of which was like, you are all in your hands. Your whole brain is just like in your hands. So as a child, I just threw you at any material practice I could find. So I did stone carving as a little kid. I did.
Oh, wow.
Ceramics. I did sewing. I did painting. I did like clown school.
Amazing.
My mom just decided like, go do stuff with your hands. So that is really where it started, is this like, I am very as an autistic person, I'm very like sensory seeking in like touch and like texture and material. I like to be touching stuff. So that's part of it. And then I think the other part was, so after I had my brain injury at 10 years old. And so recovering that was quite intense. And then I had like a relapse and recovery. And I relapsed and recovered like a few times. And one of those was when I was in, I think I was a sophomore in college. I might have been a freshman. I don't know. It was like in the middle of college. And I relapsed very severely. And I lost, like, I was in film school. I lost access to my creative community. I lost access to the practice that I had been developing at film school. And I was just sort of like, again, just stuck essentially in bed by myself with no access to school, because that was before, I'm so old, that was before you could do remote things.
Yeah.
Remember when we couldn't do remote stuff?
Yes, I do. I do remember this.
The internet existed, but we did not have remote collaboration.
No.
So I was like really stuck in this environment, and I came across Art 21. Art 21 is made by PBS. At the time, I watched it just like on television. And it was basically a show that documented the practices of contemporary artists. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. I'd never really thought of being a contemporary artist. And so I just started laying in bed, very ill, just copying all of the pieces that I liked from the show. Mm-hmm. There was a piece, Janine Antoni made this enormous braid out of all of her like old clothes and all these materials. And I was like, I can do that. So at this point, I made this huge braid. And like, Andrea Zittel made this uniform project where she crocheted all of these dresses that she would wear for a season. And I was like, well, I can crochet. I could learn how to do that.
Yeah.
So I just, it was from copying that I made like my first like really big pieces. So I made these enormous, like the size of a 3-person sofa, huge crochet sculptures. And those sculptures eventually, I think a few years later, like went on to the Smithsonian and the Kennedy Center. And like the Armory show, and that's sort of when I started realizing like, oh, this weird stuff I'm doing like can go live in the world. Interesting.
Yeah, amazing.
That's sort of my background, and then from there I went to grad school and have just been developing the practice more and more, and then I started making computational prosthetics using AI and computers to build like a masking machine, which is like a wearable screen essentially that simulates eye contact with an audience member and like masks my face, or prosthetic memory, which is an AI that helps me reminisce but also lets an audience member experience my memory in the same way that I do. And so those sort of prosthetics, those were the ones that started like showing internationally. And then I got like awards from, what are they called? The European Arts Commission, and now the Disability Futures Fellowship for the Ford Foundation. So it's sort of like grown very slowly over time to be more of a, like an actual career. Not that it makes any money, but as opposed to just like a thing I do as my own like experimental shell.
Yeah. Cool. Like that's, it sounds like it's been something that you'd be doing all of this anyway. And then you have those monumental experiences where you are stuck in bed and you're like, this is still a thing I need to be doing with my hands. And then that art show just like opens up this world of, okay, well, here's some things you can do with your hands while you are still in bed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely realized like more recently that one of my patrons called it my practice is centered around being collapsible. So like I don't do anything messy or dangerous or loud. Like everything I make has to be like at any moment I have to be able to like set it down and have it be like paused forever while I just like be sick in bed. And then, like, when I feel like I can do it again, I can, like, pick it back up again. That sort of, that relationship has definitely influenced what I do make is that bed life. And that's why I wanted other people to feel like your bed life, when you are chronically ill, like, that is a place of, like, generative, beautiful life. It's not, often we think of like bedridden as like, oh, you are separate from the universe now.
Right. Shunned, like, be shunned.
Like that's part of living. That's part of the way that humans experience the world. And it is a place where you can create and communicate and, you know, all those things. So
yeah. And you maintain your value while you are laying in bed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you even if you know, make nothing. And do nothing while you're in bed, which is also totally fine. Like, you are, you are contributing this, like, place and experience that you can tell other people about, and it will change their idea of how the world works and what it means to be a person.
Yeah.
Like, you have a very, like, important and valuable, like, role. And that isn't to say, like, oh, well, don't treat people who are in pain because it's beautiful. Pain is so beautiful. Right. That's not what I mean.
Sure.
I just mean that, like, when your experiences matter and when you communicate those experiences to people, like, you change the world.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that's part of how we're building a future where, you know, we value everyone. The work of building the future that we want to live together is being able to recognize and understand other people's lived experiences, and that is a lived experience that a lot of people just don't recognize.
Yeah. Yeah, unless it happens to you or someone you know, you don't think about it.
Yeah.
Here we had some technical difficulties, but I wanted to leave this piece in because something that M said was very profound to me. So I'm going to leave it in for you all. Okay. How are we doing now?
I think it's okay now.
Okay, cool.
This is part of like building patience and building a tolerance for patients, for other people, for technology. Like, that's a big part of disability justice, because you have to learn to move at the speed of your values and not at the speed of expectation. Like, the speed of your values is to go slow and take a breath and like understand that other people are not always going to be able to function at the speed that you want them to. And, you know, sometimes that means like, oh, well, the technology that's our access device, this is an access device that we're using right now, right? Like this mm-hmm. being able to speak to each other remotely is accessibility. And often when accessibility technologies fail, we can get like super frustrated and be like, okay, right. Well, we'll just not use it. But sometimes in like public spaces, people will be like, oh, we'll just keep going. We'll fix it later. It's like, no, we can move at the speed of our values. We can slow down. We can make sure that we center access over speed. We can do all those things. Patience is a skill that we practice together.
Yes, I love that. And I love that we're having these technical difficulties right now. That is just so perfect. And you're the perfect person to have technical difficulties with to talk about all of this. And I really appreciate you, you know, telling me to be patient, because I absolutely am not patient. So amazing.
It's hard.
It is hard. And yeah. You know, especially, I mean, we just want things right now, because that is how everything is flying at our attention spans at any given point in time. So,
and I think also our culture has this idea that patience is something that you have. Mm. It's not a skill that you develop over time. It's like,
yes,
patience is a virtue. No, no.
Uh-huh. Totally.
Patience is not a virtue.
Yeah. Patience is a practice.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. I would love to talk about some of your favorite outcomes to come out of art school in bed, either with people or projects that you've come up with or connections you've made.
Well, this podcast is one. This is fun.
Ooh, yay.
My two favorite things are the response that it's gotten from people. A lot of perspective changing, I guess, happening in my comments and my DMs now, or people are referring to the videos as like, oh, this sort of like changed my understanding of a thing, or this helped me reframe something. Because that's really what the goal of the project is, to reframe creativity and disability and constraints. And then my other favorite is just that I am learning more about how to craft like a story that helps change perspectives.
Yeah.
When I started, I didn't quite understand like what would be valuable to people, or what would be meaningful, or what kinds of stories people wanted to engage with. And so I think I've been able to like better understand my own story that I'm trying to tell. And I think that has just helped me like with grant writing and with some other like projects I'm doing, like remember to come back to like specific values in all of my storytelling. So yeah, it's sort of like helping mm-hmm. people change perspectives. And it's also helping me learn how to do that with people, how to develop that skill of storytelling and teaching and communication. Cause I've never been a teacher before. I've never intended to like, I'm going to teach a thing now. It's helped me get a little bit more clarity on like what I understand myself and how to communicate it to other people.
Amazing. I love that you're having those experiences and those that you're changing in that way, and then also changing other people. It's like a great ecosystem for change all around, is like that sharing and connection and teaching. Love that. Cool. I think I'm lagging again. What were you going to say going forward?
Going forward with the project, I would like to highlight more like project-based learning. So like recently I made this piece called Art Armor that I built for one of my patrons who's now like hosting and taking care of this piece of art that they wear. And I'd like to sort of bring in more like, this is a project, this is like ideas around it, and these are like how you can integrate those ideas into your own practice. Currently I haven't like worked specifically like from much of my art, so I want to like incorporate that more.
I love that idea. And I really liked, I watched a video that you made about the Art Armor, about, you know, sharing art that's not transactional. And like you mentioned, hosting a piece, not owning a piece. And I think that's a really cool way to share art and allow art to move about the world. Do you want to say more about that?
Yeah, so this this originally started because people would email me and say, like, I really love your work. I would really love to own a piece of your work. I definitely can't afford it. And I decided, like, well, why does that matter?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I have enough money to live from my day job, like, do I need to sell my work in order for my work to, like, be meaningful and valuable? And I was like, well, no.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided that I would, lend people work, and we sort of worked out this relationship where I own the work, and if I need the work back at any point, like, you will send it back to me. And in the meantime, like, you are the host, so your relationship with the work is part of the like finishing process. Like, the work isn't done just because it left my studio, but now it's like having a life with you. And so now I have, I think, three hosts now. And I'm building relationships with a few people to like have more hosting relationships. And then my goal with these projects is to document the piece living with the person, collect that documentation, and then sometime in the future, like, show these works in physical space where they have like dirt, and maybe they have like a smell from your home, or they have like a stain or tears, things like that. And share the work like with the life that it's lived with you, and that sort of documentation becomes part of the work itself, as opposed to just like, I sell work, I lose all control of its existence in the universe, and now like it just leaves forever, which is, I don't make enough pieces for that to be comfortable for me. So yeah, that's sort of this hosting relationship has helped me like make work specifically for like disabled, trans, low income bodies, and have the work like be in relationship with the kinds of bodies that I want to value.
Yeah, that's such a beautiful way of sharing your work in a way that aligns so perfectly with your values, and making art accessible for everybody who art typically would not be accessible for.
Yeah. If I could just get grant funders to understand that it matters that people who don't currently have access to art should have access to it, they don't care.
God, truly.
Like, if it doesn't end up in a prestigious like exhibition location, you might as well just like not even talk to them,
which is just trash.
it's very frustrating.
A
lot of funders are like, yes, we want to support art making for people who don't have access, for like underrepresented communities. I'm like, well, I can give you the most underrepresented community, people who cannot access public art because they cannot leave their homes.
Nope. Oh, no, not that.
We didn't mean those people.
That's not glamorous enough.
Yeah. It's interesting how underrepresented people have to be shiny in order to gain access to representation. Like Black people are allowed to have representation as long as they're fucking gorgeous.
Yes, exactly. And like, you know, yeah, there's so many stipulations with that. Like, okay, well, yes, you can be a minority, but you have to be well-educated. You have to be beautiful. You have to have money. And then you will be accepted. It's, yeah.
Yeah, you have to be well-spoken. I'm putting air quotes around right. well-spoken. Like, all of that. And that's why, like, your commitment to ugliness is so important. Like, we know that ugliness in people has been used as a literal legal tool to separate mm-hmm. people from the community. Like, oh, I don't want to see that.
Yep.
Like that was a law in the United States. Like, ugliness was outlawed.
Was it really? Oh my gosh, I need to look this
literally,
up.
Like, the ugly laws, you should look them up. Oh, it my is God. Wild. It was basically just saying that, like, if we don't want to look at you, we don't have to let you be in public. That's basically what the law said.
That is truly wild.
Yeah.
And I can't believe I haven't heard of this before, and I'm absolutely going to go down an entire rabbit hole of it.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad to be the person to bring the ugly laws. It basically outlawed disabled people's access to public space if their bodies did not conform to, like, a very specific, narrow definition of, like, what was publicly and socially acceptable.
Oh my God.
And we carry, like, we don't have legal, like, anti-ugliness laws now, but we do carry forward a culture of, like, preference for and giving funding and money and, like, prestige and, you know, we put the prettiest people in the movies. Like, all of those things are still, like, very prevalent in our culture.
Yeah, definitely. Wow. I'm so excited to look into this. Yeah, it's definitely rippled out. It's still... very present, for sure.
Hey writer, are you feeling adrift in your writing practice? Like the words swept you out to sea, but you have no idea where you're going?
Climb aboard the writer's helm. I'm Lauren.
And I'm Gabby.
And we're both writers and professional editors who are here to support you on your writing voyage.
With the writer's helm, you get access to group co-writing sessions, Q&A sessions, our private community chat room, and group coaching calls to help you along no matter what stage of the writing process you're in.
Members of our crew have said that they've reconnected with their excitement for writing and feel energized from the support they've received from us and each other.
You can sign up for the writer's helm at any time, which comes with a 1-week free trial to make sure that we're the right crew for you.
You don't need to navigate these stormy seas alone. Let the writer's helm take you to new shores. I would like to talk about some of the things that you, like, some of the kind of roadblocks that you encounter, not just with your disability, but also with the things that, you know, just like perfectionism, imposterism, fear of failure. What's your experience of those types of things, especially through the lens of your disability, that you've encountered, and how have you approached those things?
I think my disability gives me an advantage over people who don't experience physical limitation when it comes to fear of failure and perfectionism, especially. Mm-hmm. There is nothing I could do in my art practice that comes even close to the failure of, like, oh, I am 15 and learning to walk again. Like, There is nothing comparable in my life to the extent to which I have had to deal with disappointment when it comes to, like, my body's ability to do things. Like, I get 115 migraine attacks a year. Like, there's nothing that art could do to me that's, like, worse than what I already have, like, learned to deal with.
Yeah.
So I don't have perfectionism because, like, I don't have the energy. I just fully don't.
I appreciate that so much. I don't have time for that. I don't have energy for that. No.
I just don't. Like, I only have so many hours a day I can look at a screen before my brain melts down. And when the timer goes off, I'm just like, well, I guess we're done doing that. So I feel like in some ways, like, I have a lot of, like, skill advantage in those things. But a lot of the roadblocks I come up against are other people's understanding and, like, willingness to believe in, like, disability-specific work, which we've talked about a bit. And then my other one is just, like, I get depressed. And so I don't have, like, a clinical, like, constant depression, but I definitely have, like, one of my biggest hurdles is just, like, I, for example, this year, I have spent the last 10 months in a row getting endless rejections from every grant and fellowship. Like, literally everything I've applied to for 10 months has been rejected.
Wow.
And that is hard because I spent, you know, my very limited amount of energy, like, writing all these applications and, like, nothing goes forward. And I can get really just, like, a folded in feeling around that, like, this sort of collapsed kind of, like, shoulders hunched, chin down, like, that kind of feeling can, like, really catch me. And it's hard. Like, it's really hard to deal with that level of, like, rejection, especially like, autistic people tend to be, like, very sensitive to rejection rejection dysphoria and rejection sensitivity. And I just feel every time it feels like a personal, and everyone's like, don't take it personal. Like, I wish I knew how to do that.
Yeah.
I wish I knew how to not take rejection personally, but I don't know how to do that. So I think, dealing with rejection is really hard for me. Dealing with this, like, I'm experiencing it a lot right now, that, like, folded in depression feeling is like a really struggle I'm really struggling with right now. My disability itself can be a big hurdle, but, like, I'm very used to it. So it doesn't feel as much like a like, it doesn't have the immediacy of, like, feeling rejected or something like that. Yeah, so those are my big hurdles.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And so easy to fold in on yourself, like you said. Just and it's so easy. Like, when people say don't take it personally, it's just like, of course you're going to take it personally. It's, you've poured your heart and soul into this art and into, you know, and also, like, you need to live, and then you have, like, and then the getting the rejections, of course it feels personal. I think, I totally get that. And oh yeah, there's a dog in the background.
And I think too, like, right now, so I'm getting, like, job rejections, I'm getting grant and art rejections, and then I'm also, like, I just wrote my first novel, and so I'm also getting novel rejections, a novel of disabled people in the future, basically. That's the whole pitch for the book. Is, did you know that there's sci-fi where disabled people exist? Because it turns out this is not a thing.
You mean we didn't come up with the solution to fix all problems ever in the future? I don't understand.
So it's just been, like, it's not only like, oh, I'm getting a lot of art rejection. It's like a multifaceted level of rejection.
Yeah, coming at you from all angles. My God.
Yeah.
That must be so difficult.
It's definitely emotions. There's so many emotions.
Yeah. Is there anything you've found helpful or something that you are hopeful toward right now?
Helpful
or hopeful? Either or.
Or hopeful. I think the helpful thing for me can be, this is going to sound terrible, giving up. I give up all the time. And I don't mean, like, I'm never doing anything ever again. Like, that's not what I mean. But giving up, I'm just like, you know what? Fuck this.
Like,
I give up for now until, like, I feel better, or tomorrow, or I've eaten, or like I give up a lot. Mm-hmm. And it feels good. It feels so good to give up. Like, if you're trying to do this thing and it's super frustrating and you keep trying, and eventually I'm just like, you know what? No. I'm not doing this.
Hell yeah.
So giving up, I think, is like a really useful tool to just feel better, even if it's temporary. Even if you don't like really, you know, like never work on that project again, even if you put it aside for a week, like giving up feels amazing. I love giving up. And then I think my other like helpful thing is just learning to develop a rest practice. And I'm mm-hmm. still working on this. So I often can be a person who's like, I work until I get sick. Like I will like keep working until, oh, I get a migraine attack and I'm in bed for 8 hours in a row or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I've been trying to develop more of a like active rest environment. Where am I laying? Am I reading a book? Like, what are the environmental triggers that are telling my brain that what we're doing right now is practicing our rest dance, like mm-hmm. practicing our creative like rest thing. Because if I don't approach it with a lot of intentionality, I will just sort of like fall back into like that touching that we talked about earlier, that like strong desire for my hands to like be touching things. Mm-hmm. I will fall into that. And so I need to have an environment developed and a habit developed of rest. And sometimes I do better at it and sometimes I suck at it, but that's okay. I'm working on it.
That's okay. I love that. Those are both excellent, helpful things, giving up and intentional rest. Yeah. I think those are both great.
And I think my hopeful thing is just that my values are the right ones.
Yeah.
And even if I don't manage today to get every disabled person on earth to feel valued and seen and heard and loved, like maybe I'll get 1% closer to that, or even 0.00001% closer to it. Like, by loving and valuing myself, or loving and valuing this one person who I make this one piece of art for, like my values are correct. And if I follow them, even to the smallest degree, like I am contributing to Kunalam, to the healing of the world, and to that, like that loving action, even if it's the tiniest action, like, yeah, my values are right. I'm right.
Yeah. Yes, coming back to those values. I mean, your values are right. They are correct. I appreciate them, and they resonate with me so much. Okay, I think we're getting close to the end here. I like to ask all of my guests at the end of each episode, what is something ugly that you've made recently?
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited about this. So I have been practicing a sewing machine embroidery, not the like beautiful automated kind that you do with a computer, but literally just like holding a piece of fabric in a sewing machine and like moving it around weird. Uh-huh. And so I tried to do like a face, like a quilted face with all machine embroidered. And then I tried to do I was trying to practice like lettering, what would lettering look like? So I put like crypt time, and let me tell you, it is the most horrific looking. It's so bad. Every time I like have it up on the wall, it's so bad.
Uh-huh.
And every time I look at it, I'm just like, you know what? You really tried a thing there. You really did. I'm like, you're really working it. I'm really proud of you. It's horrible.
I love putting ugly art up on the wall and be like, look, I did the thing. It's terrible. Oh, that's so good.
And it just feels very liberating, I guess, to like really try your hardest and then for your hardest to come out and be like, well, that was trash. Good job.
Oh, yeah, that is, ain't that just the way?
Also, like, I have a lot of art skills. Like, you know, like, it's not as though I'm looking at, like, everything I've ever made and been like, well, you're shit at that. Like, It's really nice to come up against something that's ostensibly, like, you're an artist, you can make a thing, and have it come out, like, so bad, because it really highlights, like, where your skill gap is. Yeah. And similar with, like, I recently made this mug for the first, like, I did a hand-built ceramic mug. I had never made a mug before. And I went through the whole process and I was like so excited about it. And then I tried drinking at it for the first time and I was like, oh, this is a horrible experience. The texture against my lips is horrific.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But it really showed me, like, oh, this is you can get better at this. Like, this is a skill gap that you have that you can, like, really chase after if you want to. And I decided, like, I don't want to chase that skill gap. Uh-huh. But the ugliness really, like, lets you recognize sort of like a new path through the forest that you can take if you want to.
Yeah.
But you don't have to, but you know, like, the machine embroidery, that is a path that I'm chasing more. Like, it's interesting, I'm trying it more, like, I'm playing around with it. But without the ugly first step, you don't even know that the path is there.
Yeah, exactly. I love that analogy, and I'm so excited to share this with people and just, yeah, go down the weird paths, follow the weird things that will turn out ugly, and you might be really interested and excited about it. You never know.
Yeah, like, the things you're good at, a long time ago you, like, walked down them so many times that you made them into this, like, really nice, like, maybe it's, like, paved now, it's super smooth, you get to ride your bike down it super fast, you can always get to the place you're going, like. But you can make new versions of that. But when you start down them, it's just, like, full of weeds. And, like, every single branch is, like, hitting you in the face. And you're getting stabbed with all the vines. Like, that's what path building is like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you don't have to build every path. And sometimes you can follow a path that, like, someone else has, like, a little bit bushwhacked for you. Mm-hmm. And, like, you can learn from, like, their path. And that's great. But every time you start a new thing, it's going to suck.
Yeah.
So bad. Well,
and it's like even if somebody has a path for you, like, that you can't get to that path without bushwhacking your own path to that path. And that is, like, all the times you're trying, first time, second time, third try, like, you're going to be bushwhacking for a while until you can get to that path where it's actually a little more clear. But, like, you still have to make your own way there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Being human is cool.
It is. It's very fun. We're just weird little creatures that can do new
things. We are, though. We are so weird little creatures.
Yeah.
Dogs, just chilling. Dogs are, like, straight chilling. Dogs do not have to have intentional rest and all this shit. They're just like, oh, we're not eating or running right now. I'm asleep.
Yeah.
But humans, we have all these, like, we have to have all these processes and words. And, like, it's just, humans are weird.
They're weird. We're weird and complicated.
We wear clothes. It's crazy.
It's very weird. I always apologize to my dog whenever I'm taking him out in the morning, because he's always, like, standing by the door staring at me. I'm like, I have to put on shoes and a jacket. I'm sorry. I know I'm taking so long. I'm a weird little creature that has to put clothes over my skin. I don't know what to do. Yeah. This was such a fun conversation, Em. I'm so glad you joined me today.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
Before we go, is there anything that you would like to plug, including, you know, Art School from Bed?
Yeah, so if you want to hang out, you can come to my Instagram at BlinkPopShift, and I be making art videos over there, Art School from Bed. If you have a specific art bed issue, I have made videos specifically for people who are like, but I need this thing solved.
Cool.
So you can let me know about that. I also have a YouTube. I've been making YouTube videos for 10 years. I have 6,000 subscribers. It's great. The tiniest audience. So many years of the tiniest audience. I love it so much. But yeah, I make videos there. I have sort of, like, longer form videos about my projects. The Art Armor video is there. I would love to hear what you think about it. Yeah. And then I also, if you're interested in my projects, blinkpopshift.com is, like, my big portfolio site. I think every project I've ever made is on there. So if you really want to like look at computational prosthetics or weird sculptures or, you know, all those things, I have a newsletter there. So if you want to hang out and chat, I'm on the internets.
Cool. And you have a Patreon, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. A thing I should plug. So I have a Patreon. Join for any level or like join for any amount. I post like behind the scenes like posts there. And then I also, the Patreon is where I find people to host my work. So if you're interested in like hosting a garment or a sculpture in your home for many years and really developing like an intimate long-term relationship with me as an artist, like the Patreon would be the place to do that. I have a Discord where we talk about hosting and other sort of projects. And then we also have like a monthly call where people who are my patrons and who are hosting work like come together and chat. Yeah, those are all my things.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And thank you everybody for listening. Keep it ugly out there. The Ugly Podcast is created by me, Lauren Alexander of Scribe and Sunshine. It is produced and sort of edited, also by me, and written and directed by absolutely nobody. If you like the podcast, be sure to rate and leave a review on your preferred platform and share with the creative people in your life. If you're interested in learning more about what I do, head to scribeandsunshine.com to learn more about my Ugly Art 101 course, my Perfectionism Workshop, my editing services, and The Writer's Helm, which is an online community for writers co-captained by myself and Gabby Goodlow. As always, keep it ugly.